It's time now to get behind the headlines of this week's Hendersonville Lightning with editor and publisher Bill Moss.
It's Lightning Thursday time here on the queue with editor and publisher of Hendersonville Lightning and HendersonvilleLightning.com, Mr. Bill Moss, coming to us via Skype this morning. Good morning, Bill Moss.
Good morning, and happy to be back on Lightning Thursday.
Yes, sir. Yes, sir. Good to have you. And we've got a lot to talk about this morning, as you can imagine. So let's get right to it, Bill. The Lightning, of course, it's in your mailboxes and it's on the street. I can't think of a better time right now than to have a subscription, a personal subscription to the Lightning than right now. So let's talk about the fact that during this coronavirus crisis right now, rules are getting a bit tighter. Seems like every day, every couple of days, something new comes out. And just recently, the county commissioners voted to restrict lodging and require visitors from hot zones to quarantine. You've got that as the front story here on the Lightning today.
Yes, we do, Mark. They are getting more restrictive. That is the rules and the stay-at-home isolation regulations here in Henderson County. I'd say that I think the county has gone about as restrictive as any other county in the state of North Carolina. This comes after the county, we'll talk about in a minute, did adopt an overall stay-at-home order in an emergency meeting on Friday morning. Just about 2 hours before the governor adopted that statewide stay-at-home order, of course. But this goes beyond that in restricting whether hotels, motels, B&Bs, and even other kinds of short-term rentals. It applies to anybody that would pay the TDA tax, the hotel tax comes under this. They can take no more new reservations at all. And if they get a hotel guest that drives in from one of the identified hotspots, and those are identified in the order, then that person really can't go anywhere while they're in the county. They have to stay self-quarantine in the hotel room. It notes that South Carolina, Florida, and Texas also have imposed quarantine periods on travelers from various hotbeds around the country and identifies those hotbeds, which is places with substantial community spread, as the tri-state area of New York, New Jersey, and Connecticut, and the metropolitan areas of New Orleans and Atlanta, and goes on to authorize County Manager Steve White to expand to identify and define new hotbeds and expand the self-quarantine requirement to visitors and guests from those areas as well. So, yeah, it's pretty restrictive, and that goes into effect basically until it's lifted.
So I'm curious, Bill. I skimmed through this story. I haven't had time to read the entire story yet, but I'm curious as to, is there anything in here about how that is going to be enforced?
Oh, yeah, quite a bit of discussion. As much as they possibly can, they don't really think that a law enforcement agency like Sheriff Griffin and all his very qualified but also otherwise occupied sheriff's deputies can guest by guest, hotel by hotel, with all the rooms and hotels we have here, can enforce it. The county commissioners did talk about that. The county attorney basically said it will be impossible to enforce as far as a way that the government does the enforcing. So commissioners instructed Public Health Director Steve Smith to write a very clear statement that would go to all the hotels, plus a statement that every guest would get explaining this county regulation. But and some of this may be it looked to me like somewhat academic anyway, because I went out to make a picture. It turned out at the Fairfield Inn and Suites by Marriott there on Upward Road, the fairly new nice hotel. I've recommended it to a lot of people, and it's popular, and it's a good hotel. And there were, I think, just three cars in the whole parking lot, which suggested to me there were probably no guests. You would think you would need that many employees for that size of place. So, of course, travel and overnight stays have virtually evaporated anyway. But anyway, if someone they're one of the things they were saying, their fear is that people might try to go leave the hot spot zones, even though they're really not supposed to. If you think about it, they're violating the stay-at-home orders of, let's say, the tri-state area of New York, New Jersey, Connecticut.
Right.
If they go out, hop in their car, and leave to come down here to North Carolina. But the fear is that some people may just say, well, this is too much of a hot zone. I'm going to go to a nice little town like Hendersonville, North Carolina, and hold out there. Nothing stops them from doing it, but they can't leave their room under this order.
Mm. Wow. Wow. Every day, it seems like it's something new and something different. So let's stay on this stay-at-home order while we're talking about this, because this came, I guess. So let me ask regarding the stay-at-home order. And, of course, you've got the story here about Sheriff Griffin talking about the stay-at-home order as well. The state stay-at-home order, if I recall, is right now through the end of April, but the county stay-at-home order is indefinite at this point. Am I correct in that?
Yeah, I think that's right. I think the county order is in effect until it's rescinded.
Yeah.
And under the state of North Carolina, this is apropos of what we just talked about. No county can have any regulations that are less restrictive, of course, than the statewide order applying to all 100 counties.
Right.
But they can be more restrictive, which the hotel situation we just discussed is more restrictive. That's not in the state order. So that's the difference between the two. In that meeting on Friday, Chairman Grady Hawkins, at the end of the meeting, described it as similar to the March 1993 storm of the century. Instead of having the snow out there, we've got the virus out there. So whatever you did in 1993, in terms of staying at home, you probably need to do now. Of course, this is going to turn out to be a much longer duration and way, way greater in economic damage and indeed lost lives than any storm ever has been, I would venture to say.
Yep.
But there was discussion at that time, and this has evolved a little bit too, Mark. You and I were just talking right before we went on the air. There was discussion, particularly from Commissioner Rebecca McCall, are we going to be viewed? And I think what she's called it is, I don't want them to feel like they're being over-governed. Well, I don't know. It's a pretty strong government order, but it's for public health reasons. The Class 2 violation of the stay-at-home order is punishable as a Class 2 misdemeanor, which is punishable by a maximum fine of $1,000 and up to 6 months in jail. And commissioners were very worried and concerned that they didn't want police or sheriff's deputies out there running checkpoints or pulling people over and giving them a ticket for non-essential travel. So they did add at the suggestion of Commissioner Michael Edney, who's an attorney, that these violations would have to be willful and intentional. So it kind of upgraded it a little bit. And during that meeting, Sheriff Griffin, excuse me, said we're going to use the least restrictive measures possible to enforce this order. The fact that it would be a misdemeanor, it does give the order some teeth, but I guarantee you we're not going to be looking to apply it to people we come in contact with routinely. But he's since, and then we have a couple of pages later, we have the sheriff's own video on this subject. Remain calm, use common sense, ignore various rumors, especially about grocery store supplies and so forth. But he's since come out with another video yesterday, and you and I were talking about that. And what does that one say?
Well, he basically breaks it down by the numbers, and we're going to be airing the audio of that video this morning in Local Focus just after 9 o'clock. But it's the sheriff talking about the importance of that stay at home, and he breaks it down by the numbers, and he shows what the numbers will be if all of us stay at home versus what the numbers will be if we ignore the stay at home rule. So we will carry that. For you, the audio of that video coming up in Local Focus just after 9 o'clock this morning. Bill, let me ask you this. This may be somewhat of an editorial hat I'm asking you to put on, but when it comes to this stay-at-home order, if there aren't really teeth to it, if you're not really, if law enforcement isn't checking people, then what good is it other than just asking people to do it rather than telling people to do it? Did you see what I'm asking?
Yes, and that discussion, the commissioners had that discussion as well, and Rebecca McCall at one point actually suggested that maybe the Board of Commissioners should just make a public, widely publicized, open appeal to stay at home. And that's when Commissioner Lapsley said, just as you said there, that we're asking you to stay at home. And he said, necessarily that will just mean some people will just, as he said, laugh it off.
Yeah.
And this is an order. And I think one difference, and there was just a little bit subtle maybe, but there's a little bit of an evolution in Sheriff Griffin's attitude about it, or his message to the public. And that is, sheriff saying, evidently some people don't understand the seriousness of this situation. And that tells me that they are seeing, as you suggest, people that say, well, it's an order, but I don't think they'll give me a ticket for this. His model, what you were talking about with the numbers, the model he was talking about that could happen had 750 cases needing hospitalization. And that's well over the total number of beds, which is around 300 of Pardee and Park Ridge at Advent Health, the old Park Ridge. So that's more than double the available beds in those two hospitals. So I can't answer in an absolute way what that's up to each individual to understand that it's a community imperative for them to obey this. To obey the order and avoid non-essential trips. And for that matter, I think people would recommend that if you have essential trips, maybe combine those into, you know, one trip a week rather than seven trips a week. You don't need to go to the grocery store every day, in other words.
Exactly.
And that goes to one thing the sheriff said in both video statements that he's put out, please stop, please refrain from or quit panic buying. The stores have good supplies.
Yeah,
they're working night and day to maintain those supplies. And you don't need to go into those stores and strip the shelves of all of the hand sanitizer and tissue that they had.
Exactly. And he reiterates that again in this next video. And he's using numbers similar to what Bill Lapsley said. I believe the sheriff in the latest video, which will air coming up in just a bit, I think he uses the 650 number. He says if we don't stay at home, we could see 650 cases that need to be hospitalized. And again, double the amount of hospital rooms or beds that we have right now. So you'll be able to listen to that Sheriff Griffin audio from that video coming up here in just a bit. You're listening to Lightning Thursdays with Bill Moss, editor and publisher of Hendersonville Lightning and HendersonvilleLightning.com. We'll be back in just a minute with Lightning Radio. And we're back with Lightning Thursdays with Bill Moss, editor and publisher of Hendersonville Lightning and HendersonvilleLightning.com, joining us in the studio this morning via Skype. Bill, let's get back to the headlines here for Hendersonville Lightning. And, you know, we were just having a meeting, a telephone meeting with downtown Hendersonville, historic downtown Hendersonville, looking at trying to reschedule our Tales in Town event for downtown Hendersonville. And it's so hard to do not knowing you know, what lies in the future for us, when these bans will be lifted of 10 or more people together or stay at home and all that sort of thing. And so I can't help but think, and you've got the story right here, what this pandemic is doing for our summer camp season or potential summer camp season. Tell us about this story, Bill.
Yeah, exactly right. I think aside from the public health crisis itself, There's one word that comes to mind for me over and over as far as the on the economic damage front, and that's duration. And if it's on the long end of the duration, it's probably catastrophic or so. But on the shorter end, there'll be some recovery gradually, I think, rather than instant, as some people have been predicting. But it's the unknowable, of course, that is a problem for everybody, whether you're whether you're a restaurant or summer camp. So, summer camps, people might not know how much. I think they kind of know national. They certainly don't know how international summer camps have become. And I think maybe that's a bit more recent kind of development. But they have campers, but also counselors from all over. Our reporter Gracie Milner did a terrific job on this story. She interviews John Dockendorf at Camp Pinnacle, who points out that when you think about it, the camp sits there and you think it's quiet and it's gone to sleep. Well, he points out that he and his staff spend 42 weeks a year planning and preparing for 10 straight weeks of camp. He has John himself at Pinnacle has five international members from Great Britain that travel here every year to work at the camp. And many, I remember back, I think it was last summer, John talking about the number of children he was starting to get from China.
Right.
So they don't know what to do right now. The short answer is that at least in interviews last week, Gracie did not find a whole epidemic, if you will, of cancellations, and the camp directors were telling her that they're in contact with families who have reserved camping weeks, and they are meeting. Of course, they're going over all of the CDC infectious disease kind of rules. And one thing she points out in this story that I thought was interesting is that of all places, summer camps have experience with infectious disease, perhaps not as serious as this one, but they have experience, protocols, policies for how to deal with infectious, and especially how to prevent the spread of infectious disease, because they've got children from lots of places, children and counselors from lots of places in close quarters, and so they're used to reacting to this kind of situation.
Right. Except this is that situation, to the 10th power. Exactly your point there. And so really, it's just I don't mean for this to sound the way it's going to sound, but they're really just all they can do right now is sit back and wait and see. Right. All they can do is wait until we find out how long, back to your duration point, how long this is going to last before they can start bringing kids in. Is that the point?
I think so. I mean, I think it goes without saying that there's no way they can green light anything. They can't, they can't say we're having camp. I would say that we're probably not too many weeks. As weeks go on, some of them might start saying, well, these weeks are off and we're now into, mid-June or something instead of the very. And that's about, I guess that's about when they start anyway. And that's the thing. That's about as far as some of the forecast.
Yeah.
When they would have their first day of camp with campers is about right around the time that some forecasts say we could begin to open up a bit more. So, you can see that they're just in a bind in terms of being able to move ahead with any kind of certainty either way.
Yeah, and you make a really good point when you say, some say by June, depending on what reports you look at, there are some things saying we won't be able to get together with people again until fall, potentially. And of course, we're always trying to look on the bright side here as much as you are. I can only imagine just the economic impact that camps make in our community. If they're not able to have 10 weeks of camp, if it's only 4 weeks or 6 weeks of camp. So you start thinking about the number of people that that come into this community and the dollars that are generated, the economic impact. That's a serious deal.
Well, the summer camp industry is a major driver of income. I'm reading in the Hendersonville Lightning right now in Henderson County, churning a direct impact of $77 million.
Whew.
and an overall impact of $120 million into the economy, according to a 2011 study by the North Carolina Youth Camp Association, American Camp Association, and NC State University. So there you go.
Man. Let's get off of COVID-19 for a bit, if we can, and talk about something else that happened just recently, and that is the pepper bomb that went off a few days ago at one of our mail stores here. Talk about that story, Bill.
You know, what's amazing is literally during that emergency meeting of the Board of Commissioners, this actual huge emergency that turned out, fortunately, not to be as dangerous as it first appeared. This huge emergency came up in the UPS store,
right,
in what most people think of as the Harris Teeter Shopping Center, yeah, on Spartanburg Highway, where this gentleman, his name, he's later identified and arrested by the name of Christopher Michael Murray, 37, of Hendersonville, a career criminal, for some reason pops off what turned out to be a personal pepper spray protection device. He pops that off in a little explosion inside the store. It releases white powder that no one, of course, in the moment knows what it is, how dangerous it is. Is it something as dangerous as, say, an anthrax, or is it baby powder? They don't know. There's a huge emergency response from a state EMS hazmat unit out of Asheville. This covers Western North Carolina. There were two fire trucks from the city of Asheville, and at least that many from the city of Hendersonville. There was, of course, police and sheriff's deputies, and cordoned off, closed all of those stores in that strip. That's the one that's perpendicular to the Harris Teeter for a long, long time. And come to find out that I guess this pepper spray is, it's not something that was harmful in, you know, as long as you were just a few feet away. No one was hurt. They did very quickly manage to identify. I can hear you, Mark.
All right. We're back. You were just finishing up the story about the pepper spray bomb.
I said that they caught him and put him in jail, which is a temporary residence that he is very accustomed to in Henderson County and Buncombe County since about age 17. And the follow-up to this story says that accused pepper bomber has a long record, so people can get their Hendersonville Lightning or go on HendersonvilleLightning.com and read about all the various misdemeanors and felonies that Mr. Murray has engaged in for the past 17 years.
So was there a reason for this? Was he trying to get something? What was the reason for this incident?
I've not yet found a motive. I don't know of one yet. We'll continue to bird dog that and see if we can find any explanation for it in arrest records or from the detectives or the court records.
Okay. Well, thanks for your coverage on that. Hey, let's talk about a little something on the positive side. Flat Rock Playhouse, of course. We were just talking about camps and trying to figure out what they're going to do. Flat Rock Playhouse, of course, doing the same thing, pushing their season as much as they can, and trying to get programming as quickly as they possibly can. But doesn't mean things have stopped at Flat Rock Playhouse. You've got a really great story here in the Lightning about the costume shop giving back to the community. Talk about this, Bill.
Yeah, it talks about how the Flat Rock Playhouse production manager, Adam Goodrum, was on an industry forum and heard about an Oklahoma hospital that had sought seamstresses to sew face masks in the theater in that area, Stillwater, Oklahoma, I think it was, said, "Oh, we have a seamstress, we have a costume shop. We'll respond and do that." And sure enough, of course, the Playhouse has an excellent, probably one of the best anywhere around the South, costume shop and costume designer by the name of Ashley Arnold. She plunged into that work, so she gave herself. She got a new role of making, sewing these masks, laundering the fabric really well, and sewing the mask and ironing the mask, and then making those available for, I think they would not be for medical personnel, but would be more protection for people around the health care provider situation.
Yeah, that's a really great story. And other folks are stepping up and doing that same thing. Mia Freeman with Mia's Marketplace downtown, she's got a group of volunteers that are also doing the same thing, making masks and getting them to our emergency providers. So thank you for that great story, Bill, with what the Playhouse is doing. One of the things we were talking about earlier this morning, Bill, is the fact that the news is breaking. It seems like just every few hours something new is coming through the county or through the sheriff or somebody, and they're really doing something about that. There are going to be some county updates every week now on Tuesdays. Tell us about that.
Yeah, county just announced yesterday that it will begin. I think this is intended to be a weekly live stream. It starts this coming Tuesday at 10:00 in the morning, where it will play. It will stream live on the county's website, and if you go to HendersonvilleLightning.com, that's a hyperlink where you can see where that is. There will be a replay link that'll be set up on the county's Facebook page and the county's YouTube pages. So this is really in part an outgrowth as well of that emergency meeting on Friday when commissioners were unanimously and strongly in favor of just putting out as much useful factual information as humanly possible to the public during the crisis, and they pretty much did direct County Manager Steve White, with the help of the Public Health Director Steve Smith and Emergency Services Director Jimmy Brissy and the Sheriff to put together these updates. So I think what you'll probably see is maybe those four, possibly more. There could be some infectious disease specialists as well. I'm just speculating here, blue sky, about who might be on it. But the idea is really factual information. As the sheriff keeps saying, there's a lot of rumors that are false.
Yep.
They want to dispel those as well, but give factual information about what the situation is and what people should do and what they can expect.
And just on a side note to that, we will do our best, WTZQ, to air those live every Tuesday morning. I say we will do our best. We tried to air the county commissioner meeting recently live, but they were having trouble with their feed. So as long as they've got everything technologically sound there, we will carry those meetings live on the radio station as well. And from what I understand, they're leaving some room there for the public to also ask questions. So keep it tuned here, and we'll do our best to carry that live. Bill, there's so much more in the Lightning, so we want to remind people to pick up their copy of the Lightning. But before we end the Lightning Thursday today, talk to us a little bit about this special note to readers that you have here on the front page today.
Well, that's a good segue, because you just mentioned that emergency meeting on Friday. And I was already starting what's called live coverage on HendersonvilleLightning.com, where we cover a meeting as it's going on, and we hit save, which means we update the story usually once, especially in a big meeting like that, once every minute or two. I had a lot of gratitude expressed, frankly, and that was humbling to see that. But this note to reader kind of goes to, this is how we try to stay in business. Like a lot of small businesses, we're making dramatic adjustments in order to stay profitable and continue to deliver important news and information at a time when those commodities have never been more vital.
Yeah.
One thing that, consequently, that readers will see is that this is a smaller Lightning in terms of paging, but because we also very unfortunately had to suspend the TV book for now, we gained 12 open pages there. So in actually gaining back that, the news hole is not that much smaller. But in this crisis in our coverage, our email does blow up. I think we posted 9 stories on Tuesday, and that's gotten to be where we're. If the average the average number of postings in the history of the Lightning has been, I think the number is about 3.9 stories per day, 7 days a week. If that's been the average, it's now it's much closer to 6, 7, 8 per day. And we do think that's important information. We've been humbled to receive the expressions of gratitude for our online coverage in recent days as we report on the pandemic, a story that features challenges, acts of courage, and examples of community spirit. And I tell the readers, too, that now feels like a good time to thank everyone for being a friend of the Lightning. Some of y'all have been with us for 8 years, and some are brand new. Many consumers of HendersonvilleLightning.com have been voting with their pocketbooks, and we've seen a surge of digital subscriptions, and we always welcome more. So we just close by saying, continue to support us. We've offered most coverage in front of the paywall anyway, but we're still getting, like I say, people that I think are expressing their confidence in our local news report by becoming a friend of the Lightning, by subscribing. Or they can call Jan at 828-698-0407 and subscribe to both the print issue and HendersonvilleLightning.com by telephone.
Fantastic, Bill. I appreciate that note that you have on the front page of the Lightning today, and you say it exactly right. What you're doing right now with your local paper and your daily website, and what we're doing here, being a local community radio station, has never been more important than it is right now. So thank you for what you're doing in our community, and thanks for continuing to do Lightning Thursdays with us as well during this pandemic and during this crazy, uncertain time. We appreciate what you're doing every day, Bill, okay?
Yes, sir. Thank you. We will come out of it. We'll endure it together. We'll survive it in the end, and we'll be back at some point to what we enjoy and love about Hendersonville, whether it's restaurants or just or sitting in the playhouse or walking up and down Main Street.
Absolutely. Bill, thank you so much. We appreciate it. Bill Moss, editor and publisher of Hendersonville Lightning and HendersonvilleLightning.com for Lightning Thursdays. We do it every Thursday right here on The Cue.
You've been listening to Lightning Thursday with Bill Moss, editor and publisher of the Hendersonville Lightning and HendersonvilleLightning.com. This program, as well as past episodes, can be heard in their entirety on our website at WTZQ.com. Click on air and scroll down to Lightning Thursday.